The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Valvular and congenital heart disease is presented by Dr. Asif Sarajan.
Okay, so we have a 68-year-old male with class 2 to class 3 dyspnea, no syncope or chest pain. Has an echocardiogram that demonstrates a calcified aortic valve and a mean gradient of 27 millimeters of mercury. So pay attention to that number. The estimated ejection fraction is 25 to 30%. The question is, does the patient have severe aortic valve stenosis? Your choices are yes. The ejection fraction is severely impaired, and therefore the valve gradient, which is only 27 millimeters of mercury, is misleading. No, the valve gradient is nowhere near 40, and regardless of the valve area, the aortic stenosis is most likely not severe. And C, possibly the only moderate increase in valve gradient, but more information is required, such as dobutamine stress echocardiogram. So this may be a typical question that you may see on the board. And the things that in this question that you need to pay attention to are the mean gradients and the ejection fraction. So the key points I'll be talking about in this lecture are that your ejection fraction can falsely show a low gradient, and the patient may have a low gradient severe aortic stenosis. But based on what the clinical presentation on this case that I just told you about, we don't know if this is severe yet. So this is a patient that may benefit from a dobutamine stress echocardiogram. Okay, I've got another question, food for thought. A patient who has a systolic murmur, he is found to have a bicuspid aortic valve, and the mean gradient is again in that moderate range, 25 millimeters of mercury across the aortic valve. However, his aorta is dilated. The aortic root is 5.6 centimeters, and the ascending aorta is 5.5 centimeters. Does this patient undergo surgery based on the aortic dilation that I just described? So the question may be, yes, despite the repeat, the patient had a repeat echo. This is a question that I have used before that showed the mean gradient had not changed, but what they may show you is that there's something going on with the aorta. The aorta has dilated from a previous echocardiogram or CT, and this patient should undergo valve replacement and root replacement as well. All right, so we're going to get started with our talk on valvular heart disease. So first thing I want to talk about is endocarditis prophylaxis. Clinically, you may get that question as internists. So, I was walking down the hall the other day and an anesthesiologist stopped me and said, hey, can I bother you for a minute? I have a patient here that has a mitral regurgitation. Does this patient need endocarditis? He has moderate mitral regurgitation. Does this patient need endocarditis prophylaxis? So there has been changes in endocarditis prophylaxis. Basically, the data shows endocarditis prophylaxis there's not very good data on endocarditis prophylaxis. So only the highest risk patients are the ones that you need to think about for endocarditis prophylaxis. So who are those highest risk patients? Patients where there's going to be high risk of bacteremia, for example, dental cleaning. Routine types of GU procedures, endoscopy procedures, these are not considered high risk procedures. But then also, only certain types of patients should get endocarditis prophylaxis. So only those patients who are at highest risk. So not just, you know, the highest risk of bacteremia, which actually turns out that your daily toothbrushing, you know, your flossing is actually high risk of bacteremia, more than some of these procedures that your patient may be undergoing. But outside of that, it is recommended for high risk type of patients, which are the prosthetic valves, previous history of endocarditis, congenital heart disease repaired with residual unrepaired palliative repair, complete repair including catheter intervention for the first 6 months, and also cardiac transplant patients with valve disease. So you know, a typical question may be, the patient has a prosthetic valve, does this patient get endocarditis prophylaxis? Yes, and the endocarditis prophylaxis should be administered 1 hour before the procedure, or if you're using vancomycin, 2 hours prior to the procedure. Routine antibiotic prophylaxis for patients with native valve disease and no prior history of endocarditis is not recommended. So that patient I was approached about, not recommended. So I'm going to first talk about mitral stenosis. And for this one, the thing to remember is rheumatic fever is the most common cause of this. There may be other things that can mimic mitral stenosis, left atrial tumor, thrombus, core triatrium, and think about your patients with mitral annular calcification. Those patients may also have some amount of mitral stenosis. Normal mitral valve area is 4 to 6 centimeters squared. The one to remember here for your exam is less than 1.5 centimeters squared or a gradient greater than 10 millimeters of mercury. Very severe is less than 1 centimeter squared. So you may have a question with those numbers. Severe mitral stenosis, as I said, remember that number 1.5 centimeters squared and the gradient of greater than 10 millimeters of mercury. You may have a diagram like this. Here you have a left ventricular waveform at the bottom, left atrial waveform, and then you can see there's a gradient there between the left atrium and left ventricle. So the symptoms, the clinical presentation that you may see, shortness of breath, congestive heart failure. The patient may have hemoptysis. The patient may also have this Ortner syndrome, hoarseness due to compression of the left recurrent laryngeal nerve. Pulses are small due to decreased cardiac output. And the neck veins may be increased if the patient has right heart failure. On your examination, they may tell you about an opening snap, and it is in early diastole, and high frequency, and the thing to keep in mind here is the opening snap occurs earlier as mitral stenosis worsen. If your opening snap is absent, that is possibly a heavily calcified valve, so keep that in mind. They may throw that in there in the question because that patient may not be a good patient for percutaneous repair. On auscultation, you will have a low pitch diastolic rumble at the apex, and as the mitral stenosis murmur lengthens, mitral stenosis is worse. If you see the term presystolic extenuation, that implies the patient is in sinus rhythm. Because of the atrial kick, you're going to have that presystolic accentuation. These are some of the maneuvers. Increase in intensity is going to be squatting, amyl nitrate, exercise, decrease in intensity, Valsalva. Complications, heart failure, systemic embolism, and CVA is going to be one of the most common things. It's mostly because of atrial fibrillation. 80% of these patients are going to develop atrial fibrillation. This is one thing that you may have on your boards. anticoagulation. So, you know, remember that the novel anticoagulants that we are using nowadays, they're not indicated for valvular heart disease patients. Non-invasive testing, atrial fibrillation, left atrial enlargement, right ventricular hypertrophy, and left atrial enlargement actually correlates poorly with severity. If you have a pulmonary artery, RV, and RA enlargement, you have severe mitral stenosis. On echocardiogram, you will see thickened, restricted leaflets. You have a leaflet doming, and you have a decreased EF slope that you may see. On the Doppler study, we look at the gradient, valve area, pulmonary artery pressure. So this is what this is a parasternal view of the mitral valve. You can see on the left-hand side is the left ventricle. The markings that say A and P, that's the anterior and posterior leaflet. The LA is the left atrium. Above that is the aortic valve. And you can see that there is thickening of both the leaflets, and there's also doming of the leaflets. So the medical treatments for this, anticoagulation, heart rate control, diuretic. So you may have a typical patient who comes in, who's described in this, case where they're presenting with atrial fibrillation. The key here is if the patient is symptomatic, trying to control their heart rate. If you're unable to control their heart rate, this is a patient that may require cardioversion. And when you do anticoagulate this patient, remember to use warfarin. And diuretics may be needed if they're in congestive heart failure. The surgical treatments, mitral valve repair, balloon, and if you have a mitral valve area less than 1.5 centimeters squared and symptoms, or if you have the pulmonary artery pressure greater than 50 millimeters of mercury or 60 millimeters of mercury with exercise, new onset atrial fibrillation, or very severe mitral stenosis favorable to balloon intervention. So remember the key things here are the number one, the symptoms. Number two, the valve area that I just told you about, the 1.5 centimeters squared. Third one, atrial fibrillation. So if they describe a patient with atrial fibrillation, this is a patient that you may consider for repair. And then the numbers to remember are the pulmonary artery pressure. That number you will see several times, greater than 50 millimeters of mercury at rest or 60 millimeters of mercury with exercise. Next, we're going to go to mitral regurgitation. So for mitral regurgitation, things to think about is you have to think about the mitral valve itself. So you can start with the leaflets themselves. So, there could be a problem with the leaflets. So what could be the problems with the leaflets? It could be endocarditis. And think about also prolapse. The posterior leaflet prolapse is a common cause. And then beyond that, you can think about the chordae. So the patient may have a chordal rupture, maybe from a myocardial infarction. It could also be from papillary muscle rupture. Remember the posterior medial papillary muscle is more likely to rupture. So you may have a case that they describe that the patient has congestive heart failure symptoms, chest x-ray, patient is going into flash pulmonary edema, and they may show you a ruptured or describe a ruptured papillary muscle. So those are the causes. And then outside of the valve apparatus, think about also the mitral annulus. So if the patient has severe cardiomyopathy, a patient has a dilation of the mitral annulus. And as that happens, there's malcoaptation of the leaflets as they come together. They're unable to coapt properly, and the patient may develop mitral regurgitation from that. Mitral valve prolapse is the most common cause of isolated mitral regurgitation requiring mitral valve repair. So just had a patient this week who has severe mitral regurgitation, and when I looked at the echocardiogram, the patient had classic posterior leaflet prolapse. So this patient would be a good candidate for mitral valve repair. So think about also with mitral regurgitation, think about this as a volume overload. So there's eccentric hypertrophy. LV mass over volume ratio is normal. With mitral regurgitation, keep in mind that these patients are going to have if they have no sort of cardiomyopathy, their LV function, ejection fraction is going to be actually high because of decrease in afterload. In mitral regurgitation patients, the symptoms that you're looking for are heart failure. Their pulses are going to be brisk, and S3 is not necessarily a sign for LV failure in these patients. So the murmur is holosystolic, apex to axilla, but not always, and the intensity may not always reflect the severity. So if depending on the mitral regurgitation, it may actually go to the axilla, or it may also go to the sternum. So depending on, you know, if the patient has eccentric mitral regurgitation, for example, if they have a posterior leaflet prolapse, then the regurgitation is going to be in the opposite direction. Non-invasive testing, EKG is going to show left atrial enlargement, left ventricular hypertrophy. Chest X-ray is going to show left atrial and left ventricular enlargement. And we talked about the echocardiographic findings. And think about also in these patients when you are looking at discordant clinical versus echocardiographic finding, cardiac MRI may be useful. So this is an echocardiogram. On the left-hand side is the right atrium and right ventricle. On the right-hand side of the screen is the left ventricle and left atrium. The blue area there is the mitral regurgitation. This is more like mild to moderate mitral regurgitation. And this is a patient with severe mitral regurgitation. These are the large V waves that you may see with mitral regurgitation. On the left-hand side is the pulmonary artery waveform. You can see the large V waves there. You may see that on your exam. And on the right-hand side is the pulmonary capillary wedge with also large V waves noted. So there's really no treatment, there's no medical treatment for chronic mitral regurgitation. In acute mitral regurgitation, afterload reduction diuretics may be useful, especially in those patients that have things like papillary muscle rupture, chordal rupture. And here we talk about surgical, which is going to be either repair or replacement. With primary mitral regurgitation, severe mitral regurgitation with symptoms, surgery is recommended. Severe mitral regurgitation without symptoms, and this is where I use the 60-50-40 rule, EF, pulmonary artery pressure, and systolic dimension. So as I said, with mitral regurgitation, there's going to be an increase in the ejection fraction. So if there's a decrease in ejection fraction in those patients, that's a sign that that patient may need repair versus a replacement. So EF less than 60%, end systolic dimension greater than 40 millimeters of mercury, pulmonary hypertension, again that number that I was telling you about, pulmonary artery pressure greater than 50 millimeters of mercury at rest or 60 millimeters of mercury with exercise, new onset atrial fibrillation, or patients with severe mitral regurgitation where there's a high likelihood of repair. Here's one, this you may see this clinically as well. What about a low ejection fraction? So as we said, with mitral regurgitation, the ejection fraction should be hyperdynamic. But when the patient has a severely reduced ejection fraction, should you send them for surgery? So the recommendations in this regard are that if the ejection fraction is less than 30% and the valve can be successfully repaired, high likelihood of repair, then that those patients should undergo repair. But if there's not a high likelihood of repair and replacement is the only option, Surgery is not recommended in those patients, so keep that in mind. Mitral valve replacement is a class 3 if less than 50% of the posterior leaflet is involved, and the keep these class 3 indications in mind, and recommendation is to have mitral valve repair. These are some other echocardiographic findings. So VC is a vena contracta, less than 0.3, volume less than 30 mLs, regurgitant fraction less than 30%, ERO, which is the effective orifice, regurgitant orifice, less than 0.2 centimeters squared. Severe is vena contracta greater than 0.7 millimeters, volume greater than 60 mLs, and regurgitant fraction, this should be the other way, it should be greater than 30, ERO greater than 0.4. So these are some of the things that we use on echocardiogram. I don't think they'll ask you some of these questions, but and we look at the volume, and also how big the jet is, and the effective regurgitant orifice, which basically means that how big of an area within the mitral valve that is regurgitating. Okay, so mitral valve prolapse, prevalence is 5 to 10% of the populations. Most of them are asymptomatic. Some of them you may see, they have palpitations, chest pain, there's mid-systolic click and late systolic murmur. Some of these maneuvers that they didn't transfer over well, so I will get you guys the correct slides. EKG, usually normal. The patient may have paroxysmal supraventricular tachycardia. There's an increased incidence of WPW. Chest X-ray is not helpful. So the echocardiogram will have leaflet abnormalities. And you know, these are the patients who will have a significant mitral regurgitation, especially a lot of the times we see posterior leaflet prolapse more commonly. So this is another echocardiogram. This is a peristernal view. On the top is the right ventricle, ventricular septum, left ventricle, aortic valve, and left atrium you can see. DA, that's the descending aorta, and the AM and the PM, that's the anterior mitral and the posterior mitral leaflet. And you can see in this that the anterior mitral leaflet is prolapsing beyond the plane of the posterior mitral leaflet, so this patient has anterior mitral leaflet prolapse. And in this view, you can see this is the apical four-chamber view. As I described before, on the right-hand side is the left atrium and left ventricle. The posterior mitral leaflet is prolapsing. Here's another picture. So they don't show the regurgitation on this image here, but the regurgitation jet is going to be opposite of the area of the prolapse. And also, if there is tethering of the leaflet, then you're going to have ipsilateral regurgitation. So the tethering can be caused. We see that sometimes in patients with regional myocardial infarction with adverse remodeling. So the leaflet may actually be tethered. So it's basically restricted. And then you're going to have eccentric mitral regurgitation. If you have dilation of the annulus, and it looks like on this echocardiogram, the mitral annulus is also dilated. So this is not just a prolapsing mitral leaflet, but also there's also annular dilation. But with annular dilation patients, you're going to have central mitral regurgitation usually, unless there's also a leaflet abnormality. Okay, so I've seen a few of these patients. Chordal rupture. So these patients present with sudden onset shortness of breath, congestive heart failure. Sometimes the patient will even describe a pop where they felt, you know, very acute onset of symptoms. So the patients develop chordal rupture, you will have a flail mitral leaflet. So on an echo, the way you can tell the difference between the two is a flail leaflet is going to face beyond just the annulus, is going to be pointing into the left atrium. That's a flail leaflet. Okay, so I'm going to go through these kind of fast. Aortic stenosis, as we were talking about earlier, degenerative are the most, one of the most common causes. And then you have bicuspid aortic stenosis. Rheumatic is somewhat rare. All right, I'm going to tell you the key numbers here. So if it's over 40 mean gradient, keep that in mind, that is considered severe aortic stenosis. Valve area less than 1 is also considered severe aortic stenosis. So as I was describing the case to you earlier, those patients who have this gradient, which is in the moderate range, but they have a reduced ejection fraction, think about doing a dobutamine stress echocardiogram to see if this is a pseudo aortic stenosis. There's a new entity now that is being described called normal HFpEF, which is heart failure with preserved ejection fraction and severe aortic stenosis. So you may get reports, and you may see this clinically. Patient has a preserved ejection fraction. The valve area comes out to be like 0.8, but the valve gradient is, you know, like 25 or 30. So we're starting to see this now, this heart failure with preserved EF and also this moderate severe aortic stenosis. Turns out most of these patients act more like moderate to severe aortic stenosis than severe aortic stenosis. But for the test, you just need to know about the patients with depressed LV function. So this is what a waveform may look like. So you have the LV waveform, the aortic waveform. You can see there that there's a gradient between the two. Okay, so things to remember clinically and also for your exam, look for angina, congestive heart failure, syncope. So when this happens, the average survival is reduced. These patients may also have colonic angiodysplasia, so these patients may present with GI bleeding. Okay, so things to remember here, delayed pulse, and there's also an apical impulse that is sustained, left shift, there's a thrill. There's a paradoxical splitting of the S2, and the reason why that happens is because there is a delay in the aortic valve closure. The murmur will radiate through the carotids. EKG will show LVH, left atrial enlargement. You may see AV blocks, so keep that in mind. Last week I had a patient who underwent aortic valve replacement. Soon afterwards, the patient developed complete heart block. So AV blocks are common in these patients as the AV node is close to the aortic valve. So the patient may also have on chest x-ray, aortic dilation, aortic valve calcification, maybe normal. Okay, so again, the numbers to remember. 40, think about the peak velocity over 4, index valve area less than 0.6 centimeters squared per meter squared, very severe, mean gradient over 50. Surgery if severe plus symptoms, or EF less than 50%, or stress test with hypotension or symptoms. So if you have a patient with severe aortic stenosis and they have to give you an option, patient can describe a patient undergoing an exercise stress test, the patient develops symptoms, on minimal activity, patient has hypotension, this is a patient you should consider for surgery. Also, I talked about the dobutamine stress echocardiogram in these patients. This is a tri-leaflet valve with severe aortic stenosis. And this is a aortic waveform at the bottom there that you can, the patient has aortic insufficiency as well as aortic stenosis, so the patient has a significantly elevated peak velocity. As you can see, it's over 4. This is a surgical disease. There's really no medical treatment for this. You should treat them with statins, control their blood pressure, their overall cardiovascular risk, but there's no specific medical treatment for it. As I was saying, if there's a EF is less than 50%, abnormal exercise stress test. I was describing that case to you earlier about the bicuspid valve with the dilated ascending aorta at 5 to 5.5, or increase over 0.5. And then we have newer options for high-risk patients, which are the TAVR. Low flow, low gradient. So this is what I was talking about, tributary stress echocardiogram. Aortic insufficiency. Think about, in this case, the root or the leaflets themselves. So if there is what could be the problems with the leaflets? Well, if the patient has aortic insufficiency, if the patient has endocarditis, and for the aortic root, the patient may have aortic root dilation. Maybe the patient has a bicuspid aortic valve, some sort of a aortopathy. Patient may have a dissection, so the leaflet problem may be a dissection itself. And acute aortic insufficiency, this leads to rapid left ventricular failure. Patients have absence of classic findings. They may not even have a murmur on examination. These are some of the pulses that you may be describing. Quincke's pulse, basically pressing the fingernail bed and you will see the pulsations. Corrigan's pulses are basically a rapid systolic rise. Then you have the Bisfrin's pulse. Think about also in this Austin-Flint murmur, and this is the functional diastolic rumble. Basically, this murmur is related to the aortic insufficiency jet in diastole hitting the ventricular septum, causing this murmur that mimics mitral stenosis. These patients will also have systolic ejection murmur, and the reason why these patients have that is because of increased systolic flow. So the patient may have a systolic murmur just related to increased flow from the aortic insufficiency. We're not going to run through these. Non-invasive testing, we talked about some of these. The chest x-ray, as I said, look for the dilated aorta. And the echocardiogram, we look for the severity of the jet. And then for acuity versus chronicity, we look at the pressure halftime. So this is the anterior and posterior mitral leaflet. With the aortic insufficiency jet, you're going to have a rumble within you will have within the anterior and posterior mitral leaflets that movement that you see on a M-mode examination on an echocardiogram. This is aortic insufficiency. They're showing the left ventricular outflow tract. Okay, so medical treatment. There's really no good medical treatments. Atrial reduction may be instituted. Severe AI without symptoms with normal systolic function. It's a class 2B recommendation. Surgical aortic valve replacement, severe AI with symptoms, severe AI without symptoms in those patients with EF less than 50% or end-systolic dimension greater than 50 millimeters. So with MR, as I was saying, 60, 50, 40, 60%, if their EF is less than 60%, PAP less than, oh, greater than 50, or end systolic dimension greater than 40. So if the LV dilates in those patients with mitral regurgitation, and that is, those are the criteria. For aortic valvulopathy, think about 50-50. So if the ejection fraction is less than 50% for the aortic stenosis, in this case, end systolic dimension greater than 50. Tricuspid, here's tricuspid stenosis. Most of these are rheumatic. Tricuspid regurgitation. So we see a lot of patients with tricuspid regurgitation. Well, if you're getting echo reports back, there many patients are going to have more than mild tricuspid regurgitation. Most of the cause of this, remember, is the right ventricle. So it's dilation, and the most common cause of right ventricular dilation is the left side. So if the patient has diastolic dysfunction leading to pulmonary hypertension, RV dilation, the patient will have tricuspid regurgitation as well. I'm going to fly through some of these here. You will see large V waves. You have the right ventricular and right atrial waveform. So look for those. Okay. So congenital heart disease, VSD, that excluding the bicuspid aortic valve. Outside of that, VSD is the most common. ASD is next. PDA, 10%. And coarctation is 7%. Pulmonic stenosis, aortic stenosis, 7%. Tetralogy of Fallot, 6%. Transposition is 4%. These are the syndromes, Noonan syndrome, pulmonic stenosis, Holt-Oram syndrome, atrial septal defect, Kartagner syndrome, and dextrocardia, sinusitis, bronchiectasis, muscular dystrophy, cardiomyopathy, Down syndrome, and we see a lot of Down syndrome patients, so they may have that on your examination, ASD, VSD, and valve regurgitation, aortic valve regurgitation, Williams syndrome, supravalvular aortic stenosis, Turner syndrome, coarctation, bicuspid aortic valve. They may ask you some questions about bicuspid aortic valve because it's 1 to 2% of the population. It is linked with aortic stenosis or insufficiency. Screen the first degree relatives, especially if they have a history of aortopathy. So they may have that on your examination, screening, aneurysm, coarctation, dissection. Can have severe ascending aortic dilation without significant valve dysfunction because bicuspid aortic valve is linked with also aortopathy. Surgery, if the ascending aorta is greater than 5 to 5.5 centimeters, if ascending aorta dilation is greater than 4.5 centimeters, if AVR is required for severe valve disease, Q1 year if ascending aorta is greater than or equal to 4.5 centimeters. What about congenital heart disease? Coarctation of the aorta, narrowing of, this is the narrowing of the aorta in the region of the ligamentum arteriosum, adjacent to the left subclavian origin. Clinical history on this is hypertension, delayed lower extremity pulses, and it's associated with bicuspid aortic valve, congenital aneurysm of the circle of Willis, subaortic stenosis, VST, mitral valve abnormalities, and they may show you a chest x-ray with rib notching, and rib notching is basically the bottom portion of the ribs. There's erosion on the ribs. Complication are hypertension, aortic dissection, rupture. So these patients need to be monitored lifelong. They may have residual hypertension. They're at risk for accelerated coronary artery disease, heart failure, dissection, intracerebral hemorrhage. This is an image of a coarctation. Here's another one. Secundum ASD, most common. type, 30 to 40% of congenital heart disease in adults over the age of 40. It is a mid-septal defect, and there's an increased incidence of mitral valve prolapse, so there may be some question there, trying to link the two, as there is an increased risk of mitral valve prolapse in these patients. There is a left to right shunt, and there is also a right heart volume overload, increased pulmonary blood flow. The patients may be asymptomatic. They may have a pulmonic systolic ejection murmur, and that's due to the increased flow. There is a right-sided diastolic rumble. There is a fixed wide splitting of the S2, so you may find that in the clinical portion of the case. So keep that in mind. Natural history depends on the size of the shunt. The patient may have right heart failure, atrial arrhythmias, pulmonary hypertension, and then you may have a case with a paradoxical embolism. So the patient has a DVT, and then next thing they describe is the patient has a CVA.